Hi everyone, a particular treat this week as I got to meet Ben Marsh. Now Ben is a reader in history at the University of Kent, but probably better known to most people for the Marsh Family musical videos, which inspired so many of us during lockdown and since lockdown. And Ben talks about how people have been craving something authentic, and we learn what it was like to perform live on Comic Relief, meeting, or nearly, Richard Curtis, and being watched by people that one has constructed one's world around. Now, Ben reflects on how some people will see in the musical videos whatever it is that reinforces their cultural world, and how the videos have endeavoured to bring people together. Music can reach people and enable us to escape tribalism. We learn about the inspiration for some of the music. We learn about Ben's research on histories of failure and how he very nearly didn't become an academic. He wasn't able to study history at school, but we learn that something about colonial America clicked for him. We talk about going back to the music or films that mattered to us when young and how we need people to validate our passions. Ben talks about ornaments that his late grandmother hoarded and how much we tend to value an archive. We discuss keeping records relating to the past and misremembering the past, and the significance of blurry pictures of a Labrador on a school trip that Ben took to the Isle of Wight. We discover how Ben got into academia and the art of retro-articulating one's life, and how he feels differently about his research since 2016. Then at the end of the interview, we talk about the selection of positive memories and what we do with negativity and positivity, and how we share our journey with other people. We also learn that Ben gets to look back professionally, but otherwise is a looking forward kind of person. A huge privilege to catch up for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews with Ben Marsh. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it's a great pleasure this week to interview Ben Marsh. And of course, Ben, now we've both worked at the University of Kent mm-hmm. for a number of years, but as we were just saying, we also have various other connections, including somebody I went to school with that you went to university with. So yes. It's a small world.
It is. It's one of those things that Facebook sort of throws up, or those kind of social media connections. Yeah. But
And of course, you're very well known, as anybody listening to this will know, for your lockdown musical videos. And when I said even last night to a few friends that I was interviewing you, they were like, oh my God, you know, that was the thing that saved me during lockdown from going completely mad, because of the way that you use contemporary events and, you know, in the style of a musical, gave a very good satirical commentary on everything, and also just made people very happy. And what was the inspiration for doing that?
Oh, it was something that we'd always done in the family, but we having shared the first one and accidentally having gone viral after a few weeks sort of stress, because it was quite stressful in those initial moments. We were right early in the pandemic, and there's kind of all this stuff coming at us in terms of news and homeschooling and everything. But actually, after a few weeks had settled in, we thought, well, why not carry on doing that if it's lifted people up? It was we hadn't realised that we could kind of make a contribution in that way. And some of the messages were at that point from key workers and people that were getting a bit of solace or just a smile and a laugh. So we had nothing else to do. We had nothing to lose. That was the sort of motivation. Very much thinking from terms of not wanting to overexpose ourselves and do something that was just going to keep us all smiling and happy and together.
So. And had you done anything like that before lockdown? In other words, was it something that you just suddenly, like, it was just this wonderful constellation alignment or way of venting? It's like, you know, we can't go out, so we're here as a family, so let's do something creative. Or was that something that you'd done, maybe not in the public eye, before lockdown?
Yeah, exactly. It was stuff that we'd done privately and not in the public eye before lockdown, and that we'd always massively enjoyed since the kids were very, very little. Getting them to sing along, you know, there's always been an acoustic guitar knocking around, and obviously if they've got older and able to hold a line and discovered more music, and we've exposed them to the terrible music of our past and kind of forced them to listen to it and that sort of thing, that actually then we've got a shared kind of canon, and then just sort of working through it. I mean, there's always somebody that's complaining about what we might choose to do, or it was already part of the family dynamics. And I think what was just, we just grew that confidence to share that with the outside world, and for it not to necessarily be a a negative thing and actually potentially to be a positive thing, which we hadn't sort of expected.
But because what really worked, I thought, in that is the coordination between all of you. Because it's not just that
you wouldn't say that if you watched a lot of the rest.
Well, I'm sure that's true. But of course, all I saw was the final version, and of course, what was happening is that you were all using facial expressions. You were all at the perfect moment. You'd be raising a cup or whatever it might be, and it just sort of fitted with the words of the song and the appropriate pauses in there as you're sort of delivering a zinger of a line. And I just thought the amount of traffic, I don't know, I mean, your YouTube views must be in the thousands, if not millions, I would imagine. And that has just taken off. And you must be looking back and just thinking, hang on, how did that happen?
Yeah, no, definitely. But the strange thing is, I think partly because of the pandemic environment and the circumstances, but also I think this is something that's true more broadly, is that people have been craving or kind of wanting to watch something that's authentic. And so actually all of the mistakes and the bad singing and the bad notes and the kind of missed lines and things like that, which we left in, not sort of intentionally, but just because there's only so many takes you can do with an 8, 9, 10-year-old before like everyone wants to gives up the ghost. And so that kind of sense of that this is a real thing that people are watching seems to have really, that seems to be what's caught people. I mean, yeah, it's always lovely that people laugh at the humour and see the kids developing and the music and the singing's all right. But it's that kind of it being a real thing, I think, that people have latched onto, because they don't tend to find that on YouTube or in other places, or at least I think it's increasingly important across Twitch and other platforms that people are looking for something that's not totally sanitized and sterilized and auto-tuned to death and that sort of thing. So that's a part of it, I think, that kind of warts and all.
Yeah, because it works both ways, because often on YouTube you can have, like, and even with podcasts, something random, and often you've got two people or more talking, and you're suddenly, and I'm listening thinking, hang on a minute, you're not speaking to the listener, you're just talking amongst yourselves. Like Zoo Radio is a bit like that. But on the other hand, as you say, something that is so sanitized, maybe very professional, but you don't feel that sort of investment. Because what you did, it was so clever. And of course, the thing that really worked is that people know the tunes, the Total Eclipse of the Heart and so on. And right. Of course, and you're doing a riff on that, which actually speaks to what's happening in the world, right then, right now. So it just kind of felt that was your way of saying, we can't get out of our houses. We can't go into the world in the way that we normally can. But actually, let's find our own language. I mean, we all did it to various extents. Yeah. We all found that we were able to suddenly do things online or have conversations on Zoom that, prior to that, I'd never heard of Zoom before March 2020. But that was such a creative way of doing things.
Yeah, and it's, as you say, there's lots of different ways I think that people were using that moment or being forced by that moment to dip back into their individual pasts and canons, like sorting rooms in houses out that you wouldn't have done before because there was nothing else you could do or you needed the space, going through devices because you needed to make them work because you needed the extra iPad or laptop or whatever it is. And so in all these slightly different ways, I think we were opening up mini worlds of our past in that lockdown. And then also, of course, there was a social issue of like needing to reach out for people because you couldn't work normally, you couldn't speak to friends and so on. And so yeah, we ended up in these in this world of kind of Zoom friendship groups that were being reconstituted from school, and that there wasn't a reason not to invite some other people. So I ended up reaching out and contacting friends from school who I wouldn't have naturally before because of the lockdown, and we've tried to sort of keep that going. It's going to be interesting to see what happens on the other side. I tried to sort of keep that going, but in a way, it was a key to open up all these different worlds, and the music was one of those. It's like, yeah, revisiting the songs that make us happy, or that lots of people indulging in podcasts and listening to new music, making new music as well. So I think it was quite an interesting moment in terms of that mix of having to go back into your own archive in a way and maybe be nostalgic, and then also being creative and an opportunity to learn new skills. And so we as a family at that point, we managed to hit, I think, a sweet spot in between, that it was something to do and it was also dipping back into the old musicals or whatever. And
and I'm right thinking Children in Need called, is that right, that you did this? I don't know if you performed on live TV, but you were certainly in the audience, weren't you, last November?
Actually, it was Comet Relief. Comet Relief. So we initially did some fundraising for the World Health Organization, and then, it was with Total Eclipse of the Heart, which became Totally Fixed Where We Are. We had a Emma Freud reached out, which is ridiculous in and of itself. Yeah. That was a quite weird thing that we had because it was circulating so widely, we had lots of people, including colleagues and friends, that kind of we had, you know, they'd not thought of us once, probably, or maybe very occasionally, but suddenly it flashes up as a viral video and it's like, I think I know that person. Yeah. And so you have this weird reconnection with people who sort of, they'll just drop you a line on Facebook or text or whatever, depending on how you know them, and kind of be, is that you? Or just wanted to reach out and say, I like that, like old teachers from school, it's kind of old chemistry teachers and things like that. So it was brilliant to have that point of connection back again. And yes, and then obviously at another level, then there was a lot of there was some interest in largely due to a lack of content. We're not deluding ourselves, so we got the opportunity to go up to studios in Barnet and do which was incredibly nerve wracking. Yeah. A comic relief performance,
And of course Emma Freud is married to Richard Curtis, and just as you were talking, though, I can see the next Richard Curtis rom com, and of course then you have the musical family. So I can see the spin off of this. I can see how you'd fit within the world of Richard Curtis.
Well, I was slightly gutted because I missed the chance to meet him. He came to have a chat with everyone, but because we'd had BBC were absolutely lovely, and we had a sort of runner. And so we didn't have a huge list of riders of certain coloured sweets and that sort of thing, or vast amounts of alcohol. But having a rider was very exciting to Tess, our youngest. So she ordered multiple cups of tea, and by the time we actually then went out to do the gig, she was desperate for the toilet. So I had to then take her off to the loo, interrupting all of the kind of very active comic relief scenario. And then that was when Richard Goods came and had a chat. But it's lovely to be in touch with people like that and to have some of the plaudits and just to feel, it's just very odd to know that you've been watched by these people that you constructed your whole world around watching, you know, Eddie Izzard's and Tony Robinson. And for them, it's just a quick tweet on Twitter. But for us, it's absolutely lovely to feel that there's a point of contact that's making sense of all of these, like your atomized cultural world. And showing the kids who these people are, because they don't particularly know. It's quite funny.
But I've always wondered that sort of intersection between the people that you only know through the media. Like, because this came out with all the various celebrities who've been involved in scandals and so on. You think, I grew up with that person, listening to them or watching them on TV. And actually, through the podcast, having been able to interview some of those people over the years, not the controversial ones, obviously, but what's exciting there is you see that they are real people. But, of course, it's very satisfying when it almost gives you that endorsement that you didn't put your faith or didn't misplace your faith in someone growing up, that if that person, you enjoyed listening to them on the radio show, you enjoyed the conversations or the interviews they did on TV, it's kind of nice to sort of think, well, actually, you know, they were a decent person, and they're still a decent person, and they're actually willing to talk about the fact that, you know, people grew up with them and have been influenced and inspired by them over the years. I suppose the worst thing, and that also applies to things like university reunions, when you haven't seen somebody in years and you go back and you think, I wish I just kept that locked away in the memory. And to be fair, it hasn't happened very often, but occasionally you think, maybe the part on a few occasions, and this is the guy who talks, you know, does nostalgia, but, you know, occasionally you think, well, actually, sometimes some bits of the past should be boxed away, but when you are able to confront it and meet those people and engage with the people who've influenced you, then it's priceless, and obviously that seemed to have paid off in your case.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there is also another dynamic, which is then, because that's kind of validating, that's your tribe, and you're kind of like, that's great. Yeah. But then it's also happened that people are liking you that you don't like, which is kind of a weird thing. And once you've put one of these things out there in the public domain, it has, like with our academic publications, or I always think of this with books and articles, once you've kind of reluctantly had it prized, the manuscript prized away from you, they have their own lives. You have no influence over what's going to be said in the reviews, whether they sink or swim or whatever, and it's kind of you then end up with a bit of distance from them, and I can bear to go back and reread chapters a year later or whatever. It's much quicker with the turnaround with the musical videos and things like that, but there's been some sort of unexpected, like one that we did a few weeks back about inflation, about prices having gone up, has absolutely taken off among Trump loving Republicans in the United States, because they see it, and this is what's really weird about it, they just see in these videos and in these kids and in our family exactly what reinforces their sense of their cultural world. And it's actually really interesting, because there's a line in that which we reference race, and we say, in some ways, I can't remember the exact lyrics off the top of my head now, in some ways we've had it easy, we're white and we're middle class, is a sort of line that we put in there in the song. And that, but these people who would ordinarily be massively inflamed by that, and some people have been, are willing to let that go because, as far as they're concerned, the bigger message of the song is okay. Like the wagon in which this one slightly problematic line is carried, as far as they're concerned, is travelling in the right direction. And so I then have to decide, because I monitor the YouTube comments, whether do I let these kind of people treating this as slagging off Joe Biden, which I don't think is particularly fair, but then equally it creates a really interesting role, that moderating social media commenting role, because it drags you, whether you like it or not, into the world of political binaries and different national worlds as well.
Yeah, and we'll come on in a minute to your research, because I know it's very much in this kind of area, but I was just thinking about that sort of appropriation. It happened with the Trump rallies, wasn't it, Aerosmith, where, you know, drawing on songs for campaign rallies, and then the artists concerned were like, hang on a minute, we're not endorsing you, so please don't play our music at your campaign events, because it suggests that, you know, we're actually endorsing that. And I think Van Morrison also was very critical of, maybe it was George W. Bush, or maybe he just said he was a fan of Van Morrison, and Van Morrison was like, oh, I'm not sure this is an endorsement I particularly want. And that's very interesting, because it happens in every case, that we take to particular artists or to music, and we grow up and think, you know, that's my kind of thing. And then, of course, you know, a lot of the people that I grew up listening to on the radio, the people I would consider my sort of, you know, the heroes, the radio heroes, a lot of them have political views very different to my own. You know, I'm probably more left on the spectrum. Many of them are right, and very sort of avowedly right as well, and have views on issues, you know, capital punishment or whatever, that I wouldn't share. And yet I listen to them on the radio and grew up and just think, you know, I completely get that. I like their type of humour. You know, they're the people I would, you know, if I was doing a radio show, I would do it in that style. But you think, so I have so much in common with them, but politically, I you know, really find their views difficult. And that just makes it... when you get a bit older, I suppose you think, well, you know, things are never quite as black and white. When you're young, you know, it always feels very tribal. But I found that very interesting, and it made me go on a bit of a journey, like, well, you know, what is the issue here? Do I have a problem with people who have political views different to my own? Because at school, looking back, it always did feel very tribal, that, you know, there were people who were conservative, people who were Labour, and people would fall out simply because they were thinking, obviously we were too young to vote, but if we had have had the vote, we would have voted in a certain way that actually polarised us in relation to our closest friends.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And, you know, music, the other problem it presents is that one of the things we'd love to be able to do with the music, and to some extent can say that we managed to do, I think, is... bring people together, because regardless, this is what happened in lockdown, whether they're in Australia or Israel or you know, Denmark or the United States, we were up for a moment, the world was thrown into very similar sort of circumstances, and I think that's why there was that interest, because it was a shared experience, and so there's a sense in which that the music more than anything else can kind of reach people and escape that tribalism. But yeah, as soon as you get into a specific issue or a specific interpretation of lyrics or a specific association with an artist or the song, then things get pulled back in. It's definitely a complicated dynamic, I think, but it's one that warrants active playing with, I think, to see what's accomplishable and what's not. I mean, I heard you chatting to Anna Neal, who's obviously in the music industry, and there's so much that's flying around right at the moment that I've had to very quickly and superficially educate myself in terms of kind of, you know, questions of copyright. If you're doing a parody song, there's all sorts of questions of copyright instantly that's sort of floating around, and you can't sort of preach from a position of too much sanctimony when effectively you're ripping off people's pre-existing association with the song to change the lyrics.
No, I hadn't thought of that angle. Was that something you had to navigate?
Oh, it was. There's been lots of things linked to the kind of music side of life in the last 2.5 years that have been hugely steep learning curves and stressful. And yes, so, you know, we've tried to find a sort of commonsensical solution to what are very fuzzy copyright issues that straddle a fast-changing music industry, that straddle geographies because there are different rules that link back to the kind of messy prehistory of music publishing and how it's configured, which is just makes no sense, frankly, but that's just kind of the way things have always been. So in lots of respects, we've had to kind of think it through, look for permission. In some cases, we've done songs and covers and spent a lot of time and we haven't been able to put them out there. In other cases, we've felt it's okay to put them out there and risk a challenge because because of the nature of the parody, or but you can never feel completely confident. And as I say, it's a very kind of fast moving picture. So the only safe ground really is to make your own music. But whether anyone wants to listen to you making your own music is a different question. But you know, for us, it's always been about our escape hatch has always been, what do we think is good for the family? And as soon as putting music out there isn't good for us, or somebody doesn't want to do it, that'll be the end of the journey. And equally, if we think it's good for us to be making our own songs now, then we'll go down that route. And if suddenly we drop from millions and hundreds of thousands, we're not bothered by it, luckily, because you can't monetize anything anyway. So it's not like there's a kind of financial interest in that.
No, and you just made me think that that was my experience with publishing, that my first book, and I thought, because I work on religion and film, and I thought, well, I'll get something from a Scorsese film. And I thought that the publishers would be, or the film studios or the producers would be very happy to have that sort of image. And of course, the questions they were asking were like, how many books is this going to sell? How much money am I going to make from it? And I was thinking, money, you know, an academic book, I don't make money. You know, I was thinking, you know, we never look in that content. And then they were saying, well, you'd need to get, I think in one case they said, you'd need to get Robert De Niro's permission. And I remember the publishers coming back, this was University of Wales Press, and they said, but they didn't even give us, his details. And I was thinking, well, they wouldn't, that's the whole point. So of course, it's a different world. And I think that's what I was struck by, that I may be writing about film for my academic work, but there's a whole industry out there that of course is interested in obviously promoting its products, but I guess they would probably feel a bit suspicious about somebody then, you know, wanting to use an image from their work if I wasn't necessarily endorsing that, because obviously the whole point of the academic book is that you're engaging in a critical academic conversation, which is not the same then as endorsing a product. So why would they give their permission, and at what cost? So in the end, there were some creative ways around that, but but it was interesting, I think, for the publishers as well, for academic press, to find themselves caught up in this world of dealing with people who have a very different relationship to the very products that I was studying as part of research for a monograph or a PhD.
Absolutely. And you know, the way that the music publishers and labels are configured is just that all these portcullises to get through, and even if you get through one, there's no guarantee that the next one's not going to shut down. And as far as if you're being creative and you're spending a lot of time in kind of practicing or working up ideas or recording, knowing that a portcullis is going to kind of come slamming down, that might jeopardise the whole point of the piece, it can be very demoralising and deflating, and you know, it's not healthy. It's not a good or a workable dynamic in the long term. So hopefully pressure will eventually be brought to bear. But they're such big companies; they've got such kind of massive control. I mean, in terms of the sort of inspiration for the kind of songs that we've done, I think looking back at what the kids used to listen to with the kids, a couple of artists or bands, it was Flight of the Conchords, who were a New Zealand duo who did original songs, but that were very clearly kind of parodying certain genres and styles. So there was I was just watching the Pet Shop Boys at Glastonbury, and you know, there's one that clearly riffs off that, but they're very clever in them being original songs, but that are recognisably an artist or kind of linked to an artist. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got Weird Al Yankovic, who manages often, because of his profile, to get artist permission, to get, not always, but to often get kind of artist permission. But obviously, we're not in that category of phoning people up, or phoning people who know people up.
Oh yeah, because he had that hit with Eat It, didn't he? Which was like the Michael Jackson song. Yeah. It was so blatantly, it was just so daft that it kind of situated that, you know, almost like if there's something a bit pompous or something's on a pedestal, then suddenly somebody will do that sort of parody. Yeah. And actually, and it's actually a good thing. And often the artist, that's the key thing, how they respond to that. And if they take it in good faith, then actually it shows that they've got a sense of humour. And I think, and it just means that people can, you know, say, well, this is such a good song. It's not going to be diminished because somebody's done a parody of it. Actually, the opposite. It shows, you know, it's like Spitting Image, isn't it? When all those politicians would, I mean, some of them hated to be parodied and appear on the programme. Others, like Edwina Curry, comes to mind, if they weren't on Spitting Image, then it showed that they actually weren't making enough of an impact. So it was the best, you know, no matter how they were portrayed, the fact that they were there meant that people were talking about them, and that was the worst thing that could happen. It's not that somebody's saying something bad about you, but that somebody's not talking about you at all.
Yeah, so that's sort of more important. And one of my favourite Weird Al Yankovic, I think he reached out to James Blunt for you're beautiful, and he got approval from James Blunt, but not from the label, I think. Yeah. And I've had my eye on that song as well because it's so iconic. And there's a bit right at the start of it where it just weirdly and randomly kind of starts with "My life is brilliant," and I just have "My wife is brilliant." That's often how these lyrics come together. Kind of see one lyric that could work and then roll out, but he's quite active on Twitter, but he hasn't responded yet. So if he listens to this podcast, James, please get in touch, because we'd love to cover that one.
Absolutely. And we should obviously talk a bit about your academic work, although anyone listening to this will say no, keep talking about the musical numbers, although it depends who'll be listening to this. But do you want to say a little bit about what you do here at the University of Kent?
Yes, so I'm a reader in history. I'm one of the Americanists. I work on Atlantic worlds and early American history. And I've published books on things like gender history in the 18th century, and just last year actually on a book called Unraveled Dreams, which is about attempts to grow silk, which is a complete failure, or virtually complete failure, all around the Atlantic world between about 1500 and 1840. It comes from my broader interests in social and economic history, but especially histories of failure, which I'm fascinated by, and the way that we often skate past them, and ideas of contingency, especially colonial contingencies and points of imperial intersection. So what drew me into this whole career and area of study really was a fascination about how ordinary people inhabit these big moments that around which kind of grand historical change pivots, and then increasingly as I've kind of got older, I've become more and more interested in the things that didn't change, and how we understand them, how we ought to factor them in more fully to our narratives of progress or development or teleology or whatever.
Yeah. And could you have imagined, because obviously that sort of research is going to be so much, you're engaging with the past as a historian, but obviously you're doing it through the lens of everything going on in this swirling, fermenting world around us. But was that a journey when you started out as a historian, when you went to university, was that the particular thread that you imagined you'd be following through, or was your way into academia very different, and that the research you're doing now sort of followed subsequent to your university career?
A completely accidental, serendipitous, unexpected. I mean, until I got funding for a PhD, I was literally about to sign becoming a police dog handler. So there was a proper fork in the road, life moment there. I fell into it out of fascination with the subject area, I think, probably. Although on reflection, I'm sure there were some pointers like further back in sort of school that maybe were suggestive of those interests kind of growing and developing. I mean, I did a lot of medieval history to begin with, which partly reflected my dad's fascination with castles and soldiers, and he's moving very quickly beyond that now, getting into all sorts of other stuff. But but that was part of our sort of English heritage visiting public history sort of upbringing, a very, very traditional in some ways. But I couldn't do history at school. So history was always a bit of an exotic thing that I had to read in my spare time. And it was a bit of a risk to do it at university. And I began doing lots of medieval history. And then it was only once I hit colonial America as a sort of choice that something in the particularity of these new settlements being set up, where even in the 17th, 18th centuries, the kind of historical people involved had these huge aspirations of what they were going to be able to accomplish with these 500, 600 people in, outposts in the southern part of North America. I was just really drawn to how they were setting their horizons and the way that all of these ambitions collapsed and how they integrated with sort of bigger themes. So I love that sort of concept. But I wonder if some of it didn't link back to the computer games that I played age 12 and 13 and some of the books that I read and those sorts of things that were probably seeds that helped that grow. But when I arrived at university, I was thinking journalism. I did lots of kind of student magazine writing, and that was something I could see myself going down, and I enjoyed that. I knew I wanted to write, I think, but I wasn't particularly bothered in what form at that stage that would become. And I didn't have any role models for what a career in academia felt fusty and uninteresting, and so it definitely wasn't a kind of crosshair that I set, age 8 or something.
Yeah. And it's funny when that happens because I did a PhD looking at film, but anybody who went to school with me would know that I never watched films. Well, I watched stuff on TV. I suppose there seemed to be more films on TV on the mainstream channels in those days than there are now. And often we'd see things just a few years after their cinematic release. So I'd watch it late, but within, 2 or 3 years. But now I sort of watch films obsessively. And it's just interesting because when I watch those films, like 80s films, and during lockdown I sort of went back to all those films that I sort of grew up with at university.
Yeah.
But it's funny watching this because I'll often watch sort of films that I know everyone I was at school was talking about, but I just had no interest in it. But I'd always know like the soundtracks of those films because radio was always my thing. That's the one area of continuity. And so it is interesting when you then meet people from that part of your life and then sort of join all those various dots, because everyone's in the same position. The idea that you can have a consistency of narrative, but it's not to say the same that you did the same things in your 40s that you were doing as a teenager. But I do find interesting that sometimes it's the lack of something, maybe that's hence the nostalgia interest, that not doing something or being aware of not doing something 30, 40 years ago that everyone else was, and then subsequently then reflecting and saying, well, what does that say about that era? Because those are the things that you associate with the 80s, the films of Back to the Future or whatever. And then you think, well, if I wasn't doing that when everyone else was, I was doing something a bit different, not deviant, but I was on a different sort of time frame. And so it's interesting to go back and then to imagine what those people that you went to school with were watching, and then remembering the conversations that accrued in the playground as a result of those films, but doing it 30 years later. And then sometimes it all kind of makes sense. And then you realise, why people were interested in the things that they were. But doing it from the vantage point of, when they themselves probably have long forgotten you or long forgotten that those were the things that mattered to them then. But it's just the things that you take with you because you see bits of a wider picture, but not the whole of it. But to be reassembling those, if you like, missing bits of the jigsaw decades later, resituates yourself in that particular milieu. And I think that it's so funny sometimes to chart a course that, nobody at the age of 15 or 5 could possibly imagine what they'd be doing 30 or 40 years down the line.
No, absolutely. Right. And I think there's something about, I don't know how you found it, going back to those. It seems to be much easier with albums, with music albums, because because they're intensely personal, and the way that we listen to them and so on, that you still know what the transition point was and how the key change happens between track 3 and track 4 on an album, and you kind of you're never going to be able to share that very effectively, I think, with other people. But there's something about the films that we found, like trying to share some of our film inspirations with the kids now that they're old enough, kind of shit, it's been really interesting, because some of them you look back on and think, oh my God, that's a terrible film. Like, on no level is that a good film. And yet it was canonic sort of growing up. And then there are others that really have survived incredibly well, and that you want, it's that weird desire to want other people to understand why you like something. Yeah. That's a very bizarre kind of, we all want to share good news and kind of, but there's something that's really invested in the object or in the archive, in saying, this is part of my life and what I like. And it's ended up with, massive arguments at home, because my wife will have a very different sense of the films that she absolutely loves, like Stand By Me, that for her friendship group, great film, but and others like it, that for her friendship group were about bonding and kind of coming through a coming of age thing. And for me, it's a very different sweep of films. And I look back at some of those. And so, and there, it's almost like a battle, because if the kids like one of the films that she liked, it's kind of like validating in a slightly different way. But there's an intense desire to want other people to kind of see that, the positive legacy, both in the artwork itself and in its influence on you. And we love it now when there's, things, I don't know, the stuff that we used to watch in the day-to-day, for instance, the kids now absolutely love, which was a satirical, I think it was only just two series made of it. It was the beginnings of Alan Partridge and so on. And there's the kids now quoting the same catchphrases from that. I don't know, it feels like it's part of now a bigger shared collective memory, because it's managed to survive. But you hit these weird waypoints, I think, because of your life cycle sometimes, and sometimes because of external events like lockdowns that sort of accelerate that process or maybe slow it down.
Yeah. But that happened, didn't it, when, and in the 80s, when everything was on vinyl, and, you buying a record from Woolworths or, you know, with my pocket money or HMV and then listening to that and listening to it repeatedly. But in the playground, if something had been played on the radio, if it got radio play, if it was in the charts on a Sunday and your friends were also listening to that chart between 5 and 7 on a Sunday on Radio 1, then that grounded, that corroborated our musical tastes, because if that particular record that you liked was going up the charts, then people, you know, if the week before they'd said, oh, what a load of rubbish, I hate your type of music, and you say, but it's the, you know, it's the highest climber, it's number two, and, you know, and tip to be next week's number one. And of course, and it's funny, but because at the end of the day, of course, if you like something, you like it, if you don't, you don't. But what is interesting is the way that we both seek validation from other people, but also we need that kind of validation for ourselves in saying that, you know, if you really like something, but it never charts. I mean, you know, I mentioned Van Morrison earlier, or, you know, a few other artists as well. Chris Rea is another one who've had some landmark hits. I think of Van Morrison's Have I Told You Lately That I Love You, which would always play on a jukebox at university. And that's like the soundtrack to so much of my life. You know, it was never a chart hit. And you think of a couple of Chris Rea songs as well. And I just sort of think, you know, but A Road to Hell, you know, you just imagine that somehow they were, you know, the massive hits because they're part of our cultural consciousness, but they never were. And then you've got like the Chicken Song or something, you know, sort of number one in the 80s. And you think, but if that got to number one, you know, then what does that say about the charts? But it's interesting that at a certain time and place, we all had our go-to sort of the people we went to or things like the charts, which gave us that sort of sense of our place in the universe in the days before social media, where these days we're always going to find people who agree with us because there are sites out there. But in those days, we didn't. And so we had it was a much simpler world in some ways, but a really quite aggressively tense one in many ways in terms of the way that we were all using the same sort of resources in order to argue our particular point.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes down to the age, to being school age, sort of in a way. And but it's interesting because that the dynamics there are of an external piece of music, and then what the chart has deemed is important, and then what you and your friendship group kind of deem important. But it's sort of ethereal in a way, as it's coming at you from the radio or from vinyl or whatever. And then there's a slightly different dynamic which I'm always struck by, which is about spaces themselves and things that are kind of tactile and physical, and having shared those spaces and environments and the slightly different kind of freighting that one gets from those. I mean, unfortunately, during the lockdown, we lost my grandmother, which is one, you know, we're at one of those generational sort of moments in the family. I mean, it happened to be she happened to be the last inhabitant of what was the holiday home in Bournemouth that we always used to go to. Wonderful memories being treated by grandparents, and a whole set of cousins were sort of descending on the house. And it's very emotional because the house was being sold. It's the last time. So what had been a massive fixture in the wider extended family is now sort of, you're mindful it's about to be lost. And the dynamics of remembering the space and the shared spaces, I think there's something about the physicality in some ways that's different from that ethereal experience of remembering. And actually, I think the way that some of it was navigated, because it was a lockdown funeral, so you had sort of limited numbers. And we panicked slightly because Mum had come up with this idea because Grandma had collected incredible... Grandad was a BOAC pilot. He flew Lancasters in the war and then became a British Airways pilot. And so he travelled all over the world. And so the house was full of these kind of incredible ornaments. And they were hoarder, you know, Grandma was a hoarder in a way. And it was going to be tough to go through all that and get rid of that and do one of those sort of big family archiving, nostalgic clear out moments. And Mum and I think my auntie came up with the idea of allowing the kids free rein with these ornaments. They gave the kids these you know, coloured stickers, and if they like something, they go and put the sticker on something. Yeah. And we're looking at that, we're going to create a sort of really embarrassing supermarket sweep of belongings, you know, with our girls sort of rushing through the house. Yeah. But actually what's ended up happening is all of these tiny little objects that were important to Grandma and that we all associated with that memory space and house are now spread out around a load of extended family cousins, and these kids are kind of building their own memories about why they've got this random little Swiss lodge or pendant or whatever it might be. And so in a way I think that turned out to be a really lovely way of trying to trying to move the memory and a sense of nostalgia and move it forwards, which is kind of a hard thing to do, even with the generational disappearance that was kind of happening there. But yeah.
Yeah, and I suppose everyone has them to an extent, I suppose. And but it's the physical objects, and you're right on that, because these days, I suppose, even with photographs, you know, if you lose your photo album, well, there's always going to be a backup. You know, who has physical photo albums anymore? Because we take footage at such a monumental pace that, you know, and it doesn't matter if you take a few photographs that don't look very good, because it doesn't matter, because they're virtual and you're not paying for them in the way that you used to, and you'd go to Boots and, you know, right, pay for and 36 to be delivered, processed in an hour or whatever. But with past objects and souvenirs and mementos, that's interesting, isn't it? Because there is something. It's not just the physical object. It's the fact that it's the association at a time. You know, maybe when you were the age that your children are or whatever, when you grew up with these objects. And that, I think, is something that is priceless. And it's hard to know sometimes, because your whole life can be explained away almost, or corroborated by something that to somebody else might just be, you know, just gathering dust. Or, you know, I had an uncle who passed away only a few months ago, and he was a real hoarder and collector. And in fact, he had so many, you know, you walk into his house, it's like walking into a bazaar. You know? But that was him all over, you know, things like school bells that he'd collect. And, you know, you'd think, well, why would anybody want to do that? But that was him all over. He'd have a Christmas grotto, you know, all year round with the, you know, he'd have a room. So he'd say it was for the children who come to visit. Of course, it'd be February or March, and you've just got this, you know, grotto with all the lights up and everything. You're thinking, this is crazy. But only after he died, that took on a huge significance. At the time, you just thought, this is a bit eccentric. But actually, you'd look back and think, well, actually, he was a real individual, very idiosyncratic. But that's what that's what stands out. And then you start to realise that is something that is a memory that you really want to have and you want to share, which I did at the funeral, actually, when I gave the oration. So it sounds like you've got lots of those sort of moments.
Yeah, and it's been a way in which I suppose some of the personals overlap with the professional research stuff, because this idea of what do we value and how do we value it, and how much effort is made to curate the archive. I mean, that's a perennial challenge for a historian, is kind of, why has this survived? Yeah. What can we read into it? What different perspectives might shed light on that? And one of the things that came through in the Silk book, which was about people spending this time on an initiative that was never commercially successful. Yeah. So the big commodities that we associate with early America and the Atlantic world, things like sugar and exploitation of tobacco and indigo and rice and so on, and eventually cotton. And they wanted silk to be in that category of like a commodity that was going to... But Europeans failed for environmental and labour and other reasons to kind of make that work. From a commercial kind of capitalist perspective, it was a failure. But actually, if you look at how people memorialise trying to raise these silkworms and grow mulberry trees, and oftentimes they would create kind of small samples that would become objects that might be a wedding veil and that would be passed down through the generations. There's a different kind of social value that object has accrued, and that can actually be passed on as well and mythologized and sort of elaborated on. But that's different. So that kind of collectivization of a different kind of value that's not commercial, I think, is really interesting. And because a lot of it actually depends on investment of time, of collective time. It's people working together. And in two ways, I think, the direction of travel at the moment, everything going digital, and everything needs to be quicker and faster, and our attention spans getting shorter and shorter. We're only interested in time-saving devices. So the long, kind of slow stuff that takes a long time and that ends up with an object, or maybe a music video. Yeah. You know, it's an interesting phenomenon.
And also, I suppose, I mean, I've always kept a diary, but having that almost, as you say, the world's very fast. And, you know, even now, you know, sometimes somebody might be a film, they might say, have you seen so-and-so? And you have, but then you think, I can't remember. But having a record from the time is so important. So I'm kind of aware that I suppose there's a bit of a legacy thing going on there. I'm not doing that overtly, but I'm aware that you know, nobody might ever be interested in reading any of that stuff. But if they did, at least they'd probably get a good sense of a particular time and place. And things that maybe the day-to-day routines in the 90s, for example, don't apply anymore, you know, with phones. I mean, actually, even here at work, you know, we had something the other day asking, do you still need a phone in your office? And I was thinking, to be honest, I probably don't. When was the last time I used it? But 20 years ago, it was like, well, how could you not? You'd have not just a phone, but you'd have also a mechanism for recording those calls that you missed when you weren't in your office. So In your case, do you sort of keep a record? Obviously, academically, you have publications and they're of a time and place. But do you sort of keep a record of all the things going on around you? Do you keep a diary, or is there a way of... Is it important to you to preserve that very fast-moving world as it's happening?
It's not important enough to overrule the other life occurrences. Yeah. I kept a diary for one year. I think I was 15. And it started off being really interesting. I found clearing a room out, which is usually when I'm able to indulge in nostalgias when something needs sorting out. And it began with really interesting reflections on friendships and what was upsetting me. And by about 2 weeks later, there were some interesting kind of angry comments about parents, sort of angsty teenage comments about parents having upset me. But about 2 weeks later, it was the teletext copied football scores of the three or four teams I was interested in at that point. And then me going, I'm too tired to write anything. And then you can actually watch the handwriting kind of falling away as I'm falling asleep. So I think I just don't have the stamina. I mean, I would be fascinated to have it now. And obviously there's a regret kind of associated with it. But I always park that because I think, well, I was probably doing something else that I felt then needed doing. I tend to feel as long as there are enough objects, or I've kept enough things, or there have been enough of those snapshot moments, I tended, for whatever reason, to have responsibility for kind of making slideshows of people's wedding anniversaries and stuff like that. And it's weird how at those snapshot moments, I'm very conscious that I'm fixing a certain nostalgic reflection of a moment. This was when the kids were born and we do a sort of 2 year anniversary set of snapshots and stuff like that, and it's weird how the other photos, and we've got them digitally, but whether anyone's ever going to have the time to go back through or the reason to go back and kind of look through them, but there are, having fixed those there, they then accrue their own sort of weird familial weight, to the point that we've had conversations in our family of my generation where my sister's been convinced that she was an event that she wasn't at, and we know she wasn't at it, and we were able to demonstrate she wasn't at it. But she is, because this is part of the everyone's remembrance of the holiday where we listened to Elton John driving through to the south of France and ended up at this, or was Paul Simon or whatever. And everyone's kind of, yes, that was that holiday, and actually, no, you weren't there, or you weren't in that. And so that's kind of interesting. I mean, my personal habits, I think, have always been a bit idiosyncratic of what I chose to remember. It would always do my parents' heads in the days where you had cameras that you had, 24, if you were lucky, 27 pictures or whatever the larger one was. And I think they sent me off for my first ever school trip, which was to the Isle of Wight. And there were 25, they were looking forward to kind of getting pictures of me doing the activities with friends. There were 25 pictures of Labradors that I'd taken on the ferry, blurry pictures just because I was interested in the dogs. And I'd, but weirdly to me is I don't throw things away, but I don't actively collect, but I have all of these memories bound up in the object. So when I look at even that picture of the Labrador, I can remember what I felt like when I was on the ferry. I can remember a load of stuff that then happened later. If I didn't have that, even though it's a kind of blurry picture, so it creates these weird, again, dynamics where my wife, who's very much not a hoarder, she's a kind of, we don't need that, get rid of that, we need the space for something else, and she just doesn't understand why I would want to keep a blurry photograph, because I remembered how I felt when I took that photograph, or what happened later that night, or whatever.
And it's that journey point, because I always found that a friend who works at another university was trying to remember a particular talk that was given, or maybe I reminded her of it, and I said, "Do you remember you chaired this?" It was sort of all these people talking about seances or something. It was all a bit of a surreal evening. It was sort of quasi academic, but it got more people into it. This was in 1992, and I knew that it was like November 92, but it didn't matter. But she'd almost like said, "I can't remember, but now you mention it, it's coming back to me. When was that?" And I had a diary in those days, but I didn't write very much, and I was so sure that there would be a reference in my diary to this, and there wasn't. But then, actually, in this very office, I've got all my university notes, and I thought, okay, there has to be, is there a way of coming up with the date? And I found, I just went through all my old notes, and I'd actually taken notes that evening of that bizarre talk. And it had, I'm making this up, but let's say it was the 18th of November, 1992. It was like a Friday. And then, of course, I was able to go to what was in the diary and the Liberty, or the days around it. And, of course, I was starting able to build this whole picture. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you think, well, what's happening in the news that day? What was happening in the House of Commons or whatever it might be? And suddenly you obviously that a bit easier to find and you just do a bit of a search there. And suddenly, from starting by just having this random memory, you're able to piece together almost the events of that day and the conversations that accrued around it. And obviously, unreliable to a point. But I always just sort of think, whereas that picture for you is priceless, and to your wife even, it's like, well, why would you have this blurred picture of a Labrador? But I suppose if you've got the combination of that picture and like the conversation we're having now, suddenly that Labrador is probably going to have, think of how much that's going to be worth.
Let's
now.
Find that Labrador.
Now we've done that now. And that picture, that's going to be the currency is going to go sky high now. People are thinking, I must see that blurred picture of the Labrador because Ben, who's this awesome musician, is talking about. Yeah. So remember, I asked you first. I want to share the royalties. But what made you enter your profession, though? So you mentioned that there were other possibilities, the dog handling, but you got funding for it, but you wanted to write. But how did you actually end up becoming the academic that you are now?
A dissertation. It was the opportunity to really own a tiny piece of the historical world and do primary source work in my third year. A wonderful supervisor who sadly we lost last year, Betty Wood, who worked on race and gender histories in the Atlantic world, and encouraged me to go down this path and get into the newspapers of the late 18th century. And I loved it. I mean, I enjoyed all the history that I did. I didn't particularly like exams, but it was that mix of being able to write with freedom and feeling like I was looking at something that nobody else had looked at. That was really, really exciting and just filled me with passion and intrigue and the idea of kind of presenting that data and then trying to persuade people that this was the right interpretation. So that kind of sold me. And it was just a question of whether I could afford to kind of go on to do that. And it's something that I always bear in mind with my teaching of like, can I find those same trigger points in people that might be new to this subject area or doing dissertations? And really, I mean, at the moment it's harder in a way because everything is digital. I think it's less accessible to come back to the object. When you're sat there with an 18th century newspaper, there's just something magnificent knowing that your fingers are and your eyes are kind of flitting over text that people in the past had sort of created. You feel a real sense of connection to the people. Yeah. I think that's what I found profoundly exciting. That's what made me think if there is a career in this, which I wasn't particularly sure that there was, then that's something I'd like to pick up.
And are you still in touch with the people? Obviously, you were at Cambridge, what, in the 90s, I'm guessing this was.
Yeah.
So in terms of the trajectory that you're on and what, I don't know if you're still in touch with other people, but and your tutors as well from that era, but is there, do you still have those sort of conversations about, where you were then, where you are now, how you've gotten from where you were to where you are now? Do you look back in that period and just think, does it feel very foreign or does it feel very close to where you are now in terms of the big political events or the social events of that day?
I think it feels almost more relevant. I think there are two moments in your career where you kind of have to do that work of self-reflection. One is if you're applying for a job or you're applying for a promotion, suddenly you have to retro articulate a kind of a logical thread running through everything you've done, and there isn't. But as you, in that work of retro articulating, you actually create the thread that you might then stick closer to in sort of future. Mine hasn't been a conventional trajectory where you start with one project and then you kind of grow pieces of it. It's been about different interests that have caught my eye because it's about diverse people. I think it's allowed me to move flexibly through what was a very mixed up kind of 16th, 17th, 18th century world anyway. But, it's very different, the dynamics in the profession and in the field. There's a recognition of how much more important this period was. I mean, oftentimes in research terms, for much of the 20th century, the colonial period of American history was just the waiting for the American Revolution to happen and the creation of the founding fathers creating the United States. And now I think with everything that's going on to do with empire and memory and heritage and commemoration, bringing in the full range of people that were implicated in these histories and thinking about how we've interpreted them and been kind of dragged down certain rivers of understanding. There's so much more that these subject areas will have to give. So it's a very exciting time to be involved in them. But strangely, I think what I might have seen in as an academic in the 2000s, as kind of early career academic, kind of setting out, trying to satisfy what I saw as the hurdles in the profession, trying to impress the people that I admired. That's been less of an obsession, I think, than it probably was as an early career person. And I'm more, especially since 2016, I think with the direction of travel globally and in Britain, I felt slightly differently about the research that I do and about it, about an average academic article that might be read by, if you're lucky, 50 to 100 people, or a book that's going to reach, you know, 500 to 1,000 people. And actually the more urgent, pressing ways in which history can make a bigger contribution to society. We're back to Eddie Izzard in a way, who had that fantastic line about being, about how he saw himself as an action transvestite in one of his stand-up. So since 2016, I've wanted to be more of an action historian in a way, and kind of really think about those connection points between the history that we study and the people that we study, and how we can make sense and support and educate, so that we can try to reverse some of the changes that I think have been kind of antithetical to to life.
Yeah, and you're right, because I remember once a family member saying, look, no disrespect, he said, but there was a book that I had a chapter in a book, and he said, oh, well done. And then he saw the back, and he said, and it was going for £100. And he said, look, no disrespect, but why would anybody pay £100 for this? And I said, I agree with you. And I said, but we don't write, you know, because I suppose he was thinking, you must write this because you can make some money on it and off it. And I thought, well, in the real world, of course, you would and you should. And that just made me realise how I'm sort of living in a different world, where it's about the peers. It's about really saying to your line managers or your director of research or your vice chancellor, although, you know, obviously less directly, and the people who you trust, who effectively or through to corroborate your position in that in the academic marketplace. The fact that you've got that book, it doesn't matter if you never make a penny on it. The fact is that you've got that publication and it appears on a CV. But actually communicating that to people outside. So people I went to university with, I mean, obviously there are people who've been there throughout the whole journey. But most people, obviously, and rightly so, you know, didn't stay at university after their first degree, let alone subsequent degrees. And you meet them again after all these decades, and then you resituate yourself in that context, and you remember, and you think, you know, with my epitaph, because I suppose technically, yes, I'm a theologian, but I kind of feel that itself doesn't quite encompass that. You know, some people know me as a theologian, I suppose my students do, but obviously to other people I do lots of other things, and it just kind of feels interesting sometimes that we're always good at compartmentalizing other people, back to our original conversation about, you know, the radio presenters or the people that we grew up with. But of course, often there's far more going on there. Eddie Izzard, who, reading Alistair Campbell's diaries, obviously is a very big political player. He was considering standing for Parliament, or certainly for the European Parliament, and had very strong views on Britain's role in Europe. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's not the Eddie Izzard that people often see. He also does some very dramatic acting. So we all sort of take the bits of Eddie Izzard that we know or love, perhaps reject the other bits because they don't sort of fit with, or they don't resonate with us in the same way.
Yeah, I think you're right. And to come back to your point about being a theologian or the sort of label, I tend to think of, and I know this is mean and unfair, to tend to think of everyone as a historian, but just most people don't realise they're historians. Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, what you were just saying before about what you were doing to rediscover that's kind of a historical practice. So theologians are just slightly more interested in the religion and the religious context or the spiritual world. And that just tends to, because I think... it's finding those points of interconnection that are going to be the solution to some of the issues that we've got at the moment with polarization and with missing the centre and with it being impossible to find a consensus and with the drowning noises of tribalism and kind of culture wars. So I think there is a connection there, weirdly, between the singing and the singing in pyjamas with kids and the working for 9 years on a book on the history of something that didn't happen. It's about making those arguments, about trying to make those cases about a sort of can we find a new sort of consensus that's not going to be profoundly destructive, and incline it towards some of the urgent priorities that we all know that we're facing but kind of keep getting overlooked.
Yeah, and just as we start to wrap up, Ben, I mean, would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones as you look back on your life and career?
Yes, I think on but that's because I've selected them to be to be positive, I think. I think probably the way that I would imagine it is most of the memories are positive, and there's a lovely pool of amazing positivity and incredible people that have inspired me and supported me, and And then there are these episodes. So like there are snapshots of badness, of bad memories. But yeah. I tend to try and think of them as as episodes or moments, so that they that's probably
yeah. Because I mean that's the whole thing, isn't it, about negative experiences? Because well, I suppose even when I started doing the podcast, I was reflecting on what nostalgia was, and of course often. I suppose it's the loss of something in the present that we perhaps we're trying to get back. You know, that our sense of the past is that we want something that we don't have, that maybe we either did or think we did. You know, make America great again. Yeah. You know, that we once had, but I suppose often it's those negative experiences that can do quite useful things to us, because to an extent, as you say, it's we might revisit the past or we might amend the past in our imagination, or we take out all the bad bits and so on. But I suppose sometimes, you know, 2016 is a good example, that horrible though many of those things were in 2016, then it's possible to say, well, if it hadn't been for that, we wouldn't have responded in such a way. So it's the response to those horrendous things. It's the way that maybe we can be even nostalgic about negative experiences. And that doesn't make those events or the experiences good, but it's the response to them. Because yeah. we're not in control. There are some things, you know, we can't, you know, whether it's climate change or Brexit or whatever, there's a limit to what an individual can do, unless you're, I suppose, you're very, very senior in government or whatever, but it's the response to those that sometimes gives surprising moments, maybe even of joy or satisfaction against the odds.
Yeah, and I think even those things that are negative and unresolved, that's where there's the connection point between your sense of the past and of nostalgia and memory, and where you place your activism and your energy in the moment and kind of looking forward. So yeah, I don't think it's sensible to kind of box up all of that negativity. I mean, there's some things that's probably sensible to do, but in a wider sense, yeah. Can you take them and move them into new areas? Can you engage with them? Can you imagine a future in which a thing that you currently think of as having been negative might be twisted to have a positive end? Yeah. Right. So you say that's unfinished. Is there a way we can finish that together? As a positive.
Yeah. I suppose it's the relationship between journeys and destinations. And I suppose as a child, my dad worked for the railways, because we get all these free rail passes. So I suppose sometimes you've got the anticipation of the destination, but often the journey there on the train was the most exciting bit of the day. It was the getting there sometimes. And I suppose it's like being in, sometimes in life it feels, even in this profession, being in a perpetually liminal space that you don't quite know what the outcome is of a particular restructuring or whatever it might be. But actually sometimes there are creative moments sometimes that unexpectedly can be found. You can say, well, it's like waiting for an exam result. You've done all that you can do, so you either just, you know, go to bed or cry for the next 2 weeks or however long it might be, or you say, I'll do something a bit different and I'll seize the moment, and then you think, actually, it's okay, I've got my autonomy back.
Yeah, but I think it's sharing that sense of journey with somebody else. I mean, you're talking to a Watford fan, another disastrous year this year of getting relegated, and we share a season ticket, and so driving from Faversham around the M25, you know your team's going to get beaten because they're rubbish this year. You know you're going to hit traffic on the M25. It's going to be a whole day's worth of travel, taking children especially who have this ludicrous hope that somehow you might win 5-0. So the only possible justification for wasting a Saturday afternoon in the Premier League, you know, in the past year, is sitting in the car with two or three of the kids, because you're in the car with two or three of the kids. You're going to be sharing a playlist. You're going to be having conversations about what might happen in the game, or you're going to be thinking back on what happened in the game. And so absolutely, I fully agree with that idea of it's about the journey, and actually even embarking on a journey, knowing that it's going somewhere difficult. Just think about the different value that you can get from those different components of the journey. I mean, lately it's been trying to do maths, thinking ahead to an 11 plus test, which is no for talking about miles per hour converting to kilometres per hour. So that even the journey's been quite painful lately, by the way.
We obviously have at least one child the same age. I'm in exactly the same position. And my very last question, and I'm very mindful that I'm asking this question to a historian, but are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
So setting aside obviously the issues with a reductionist framework, I'd say I'm a looking forward person. I get to do my looking back professionally, which is lovely, and for the rest of the time try to be looking forward, or using the stuff from looking back to look forward.
A pithy answer.
Yeah. Is that
well, a perfect answer. Actually, a great soundbite answer. We'll put that in the publicity. But no, Ben, it was just so wonderful to catch up with you. Thank you for being my guest this week.
Not at all. Thank you for having me. It's been really enjoyable.